Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
World of Secrets, Season 4. Al Fayed, Predator at Harrods.
Cash, with that you can control people.
Nothing comes for free.
Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Thursday, the 10th of October, these are our main stories. Hurricane Milton has swept its way across the US state of Florida, leaving more than 3 million homes and businesses without power. Health officials in Gaza say an Israeli airstrike has killed more than 20 people at a school sheltering displaced people. Also in this podcast, in tennis.
Hola a todos. Estoy aquí para comunicaros que me retiro del tenis profesional.
The Spanish 22-time Grand Slam champion Rafael Nadal has announced he's retiring from professional tennis. And the South Korean author Han Kang has won the Nobel Literature Prize for her intense prose confronting the fragility of life. It was predicted to be one of the worst storms ever to hit Florida. And sure enough, Hurricane Milton made landfall off the west coast on Wednesday night, bringing with it tornadoes, life-threatening winds and the risk of storm surges. More than 3 million homes and businesses were without power and more than 100 homes have been destroyed. Officials in St. Lucie County say a number of people were killed in a tornado as it ripped through a mobile home community before Milton came ashore in the city of St. Petersburg. Winds tore off the roof of a Major League Baseball stadium. As we record this podcast, the storm is heading into the Atlantic Ocean, but high winds and heavy rainfall are still lashing eastern and central areas of the state. The governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, had this warning for the residents of the affected areas.
Stay inside and stay off the roads. Floodwaters and rushing storm surge are very dangerous. And I would say that's even more so in spite of everything the state did to help these local communities hit by Helene remove a lot of debris. And they did move a lot of debris over the last 72 hours. You're going to have new debris created and you still have some of that old debris in some of those places. So there's going to be hazards in the storm surge and in the flood waters.
Melanie Bevan is the chief of police in Bradenton, south of Tampa. She told the BBC how bad the situation was.
I'll tell you, I don't really think it's going to be rescue once the storm subsides. I think it's going to be recovery. If people chose poorly and they stayed in their homes that were ill-equipped to handle storm surge and wind, what we'll probably be finding in the morning are bodies. It's bleak in some of these areas, and that's why we tell people. There's been law enforcement officials throughout this area of Florida saying, write your name and your next of kin in black Sharpie on your arm so that we can get a hold of somebody to come claim you. This is ugly, and as ugly as it is for us, it's worse for some of our partners to the south and surely some of our partners to the north as well because of how this storm is tracking. I've been in law enforcement 38 years. I've worked in two different counties, both Pinellas and Manatee, and I've not seen a storm like this. This is the worst one we've seen in this region since 1921.
But Steve Paris is a Tampa resident who was staying put.
We're in our home here in Temple Terrace, Florida. This is a Tampa area. Really, right now, we're just kind of sitting on the couch. I don't know if you guys can hear that. Something just smacked the side of the wall. But but yeah, so we're just holding tight. We got our food and stuff. We got glow sticks around the house, as well as, you know, flashlights and candles and things like that.
Nia is a nurse who is in lockdown at a hospital in the Tampa Bay area. She chose to stay to look after people. She described what conditions were like for her.
I'm in a very secure building, but it's been raining more powerful every hour. It's coming, beating onto the windows. We can see out the windows. The rain is being pushed by very strong winds outside, and we're hearing the howling sound. So it's never been like this before. Where I am, there isn't a storm surge right now, but I'm not that far away from the water.
How are you? How are you doing? How are you holding up?
I think I'm doing as well as can be expected. I'm trying to keep in touch with my family as much as possible. We're all very stressed out.
Our correspondent Tom Bateman is in Orlando. He gave us this update.
Where we are, things have really calmed after we had driving rain and very high winds. I mean, now there is still some gusts around and a bit of drizzle, but it's much, much quieter than it had been when we first arrived. And I think as the hurricane, you know, makes its way off the coast of Florida now towards the Atlantic, you know, we've seen it now downgraded to a Category 1. So given that at its high point in the Gulf of Mexico, this was a Category 5 storm, the most destructive hurricane there is, it had become a Category 3 when it made landfall. So I think the very worst of fears didn't materialize, but this is still an extremely destructive storm. And I think the reality is we're going to have to wait until, you know, daybreak, really, to see the extent of the damage. And the big fear, I think, is around the extent of flooding. I mean, we've had two flash flood warnings in the time that we've been here in Orlando, warning of an imminent risk to life, and there have been more right across the state.
And there have been people killed, haven't there?
Yeah, and that's been the other really destructive thing, has been the tornadoes. They were unleashed really in the hours before the storm made landfall right across the state, including on the Atlantic coast, on the other side from the Gulf of Mexico. And in particular there, we were hearing from the sheriff of St. Lucie County. He said 17 suspected tornadoes in the space of around 20 minutes. He said there were multiple deaths. Now, that is understood to be at a leisure resort, and there's rescue and recovery work going on with that as well.
It was billed, though, as being the biggest storm of the century. It isn't really, is it? How does it compare with the huge ones, with Andrew, with Katrina?
Yeah, I mean, that's how President Biden had described the possibility of this storm. I don't think we're there. Now, compared to others in the past, it was interesting. I was listening to one of the emergency officials in Sarasota on the West Coast. When asked about whether or not this matched the kind of one in a century, her description was it felt to her like one in a lifetime for that particular part of the world.
And it's become political, hasn't it? There have been accusations flying between former President Trump and President Biden, specifically on misinformation, with President Biden accusing former President Trump of putting out untruths. How's that playing with the people that you're talking to? Is it an issue?
Yeah, I mean, that was really interesting, I thought, watching. I mean, President Biden made two emergency broadcasts from the White House today, the first of which was with a number of his officials. And really, the second half of that felt much more like part of the election campaign, because that's where he absolutely castigated Donald Trump for spreading what he said were lies, conspiracy theories, and that's all about these rumours. One of Donald Trump's loyalists in the House of Representatives, Marjorie Taylor Greene, who tweeted in the run-up to this suggesting that the government was controlling the weather, and this was around claims that Republican areas are being worst hit by the hurricanes that have struck this region over the last 2 weeks. So, yeah, my sense is that this is something that people have been very aware of.
Tom Bateman in Orlando. So could Hurricane Milton have an impact on the US election and how the candidates campaign? Professor Brian Klotz is Associate Professor of Global Politics at University College London.
This is the height of your responsibility. Obviously, people are in dire need right now, and the government is being forced to divert resources to combat lies with unbelievably outlandish claims. I mean, ideas that the government has conjured up these hurricanes to try to hit Trump territory. You're at a loss for words for how to describe how ridiculous it is, but it could sway some people's opinions, because we know that conspiracy theories do have sticking power in modern politics, and people vote based on perception, not based on what's true.
So, I mean, it's hard to imagine that something like this has a political element, but it really could.
Yes, I mean, I think that this is something where this is the great challenge of 21st century democracy, is how do you deal with a system of government that is based on how voters perceive the world at a period where the fire hose of lies online is unprecedented, and where politicians are potentially earning some political benefit from spreading those lies. And so, You know, you have this where the government is having to devote resources and emergency personnel are facing death threats. FEMA, the emergency response unit of the federal government, is facing death threats for its personnel because of these lies. And so, you know,
how should you,
the kinds of things we should not be disagreeing about in modern politics. But unfortunately, we are.
Neutral territory is a natural disaster. How you respond, you may hope. Of course, there's different ways of responding and choices made with money. But just about the fact that a storm doesn't hit particular areas based on how people vote, you thought would be agreed and hope it would be agreed. What is the right way for politicians to try and respond to this, do you think?
Well, I hope people in Trump's own party, the Republican Party, start to speak out more about it, because, I mean, these are the figures who have clout with the base who is being galvanized to spread these lies. There's also a need on social media platforms. I mean, you know, Elon Musk has been part of this on Twitter or X. And so I think this disinformation space is something we're going to have to grapple with for many, many years to come. It's something where the core of democracy is basically consent of the governed based on what you believe is a shared reality. And that is splintering even among the most basic aspects, where humans are not, you know, conjuring up the weather other than through climate change, in terms of affecting hurricanes and the natural disasters that result from them.
The political scientist, Professor Brian Klass, speaking to Emma Barnett. Health workers in Gaza say that more than 20 people have been killed and dozens more wounded in an Israeli strike that hit a school sheltering displaced Palestinians in Deir al-Balah in the centre of the enclave. Videos from the scene show people running to help the injured in a cloud of smoke and dust. Our Middle East correspondent Yoland Nell has the latest.
Videos from the scene in Deir al-Balah show a cloud of smoke and dust rising up as people rush to help the injured. Witnesses say there were two airstrikes targeting two rooms in the school, which was packed with displaced families. They say that food aid, including children's milk, had been stored there and was distributed from the site. Israel's military says that Hamas operatives were using the compound and that prior to carrying out what it described as a precise strike, it took steps to mitigate the risk of harming civilians.
Earlier, Lebanese officials said five health workers had been killed in an Israeli airstrike. They were in a makeshift centre in a church hall in the southern town of Deir Galia. Our correspondent, Jonathan Head, is in Beirut and told me more.
Israel said nothing about this particular incident, which sounds like a really horrific one. What they thought might have been there in this church hall, according to the Lebanese Civil Defence Force, it was being used as an emergency response centre, that these five quite experienced emergency response workers were there waiting to be called out, and it was struck by an Israeli bomb, they presume, and pretty much completely destroyed. So those five are dead. They think there may be more victims. I mean, if you look at the toll on health workers over the last year, according to government figures, it's 115 since October last year, and around 50 in just the last week, 10 days. That's a very high toll, and the view of the Lebanese authorities is that the Israeli Defense Force is deliberately targeting health workers. Of course, the Israelis deny that. The Israelis in the past have accused Hezbollah of using its own aligned health services to carry military personnel, but this was a government-run civil defense center. There was no suggestion before this attack that there was any kind of military purpose there. The problem is that while Israel's been very successful in killing quite a large number of senior Hezbollah commanders, and I think they believe they've significantly degraded it, the knock-on effect on Lebanese civilians has been nothing really short of catastrophic. You've got around a quarter of the country under evacuation orders. That's Israelis ordering people to leave because they're about to be targeted. That's a huge chunk of a very small country. You've got, you know, over a million people displaced, some from conflicts previously. I mean, I met one man yesterday, just camped out by the Corniche on the coast here in Beirut. He was driven out of Aleppo in Syria as a refugee 11 years ago. He's now been driven out of Dahiya, the neighborhood that's been most hard hit by Israeli airstrikes in Lebanon, in Beirut. He's a tailor. He said, I can't get any work at all. He really was desperate. He's got four kids. You can multiply that human experience many, many times over, and you've got a country that was already in a severe economic crisis before this conflict began. You know, Lebanon feels like a country that is literally on the verge of falling apart under the pressure of these massive numbers of displaced people.
We got news that President Biden and Benjamin Netanyahu have spoken by telephone for the first time in a long time. What do we know about that call?
Very few details. I mean, we do know that President Biden did urged the Israelis to minimize civilian casualties, but he said that before. The substance of the talks, we believe, was essentially Iran. Israel feels it needs to respond to the ballistic missile attacks last month, and I think they feel that Iran is about as weak as it's ever been. There are hawks in Israel who believe this is the right time, in particular, to strike Iran's nuclear program. We know that the Biden administration does not want this to happen, that it fears being dragged into a much wider and more dangerous war.
The Israelis have been suggesting that whatever people are saying publicly, actually a lot of leaders around the world would be very pleased to see Israel take out Iran's nuclear facilities.
Well, I'm sure there'd be different views around the world, but the fact is it's obviously a very dangerous move to make. Israel may calculate this is the right time to do it. It will always view Iran as an existential threat under the current Iranian regime. This is a nuclear program that is quite extensive. It's spread across many parts of the country. It would be a huge operation to destroy it and very risky. And, you know, Iran knows it's coming. So I think that the view among Western countries is this is a very dangerous step by Israel and very dangerous for the world. And whatever your views of the Iranian regime and whether you think it's a good thing that it might weaken it or possibly lead it to collapse, the unpredictability of what would come out of an operation like that against Iran is clearly worrying very many world leaders.
Jonathan Head. The Spanish tennis superstar Rafael Nadal has announced his retirement from the sport at the end of this season. In a video message, the 22-time Grand Slam champion said he was stepping back from professional tennis after some difficult years with injury.
Hola a todos, estoy aquí para comunicaros que me retiro del tenis profesional.
Here's our tennis correspondent, Russell Fuller.
It was just a question of when, and I think in Rafael Nadal's mind, he was wrestling with the end of a glittering sporting career, which he would love to be able to continue in perpetuity, and was also looking for the right moment to bow out. And that could have come at Roland Garros this year, perhaps, the scene of the French Open, and he played there and he lost to the highly seeded Alex Zverev in the very first round, returned for the Olympic Games where he lost to Novak Djokovic, but still wasn't ready to give up, even though his body was causing him further complications with every month. And in his mind now is the ideal way to go out if you can't retire at Roland Garros, and that is representing Spain in the Davis Cup finals on home soil in Malaga next month. And that, assuming he is fit, will be the final act on a stunning career which has seen him win 22 Grand Slam singles titles, Olympic gold medals in singles and doubles, and been world number one for over 200 weeks.
What will we remember him for most of all?
We'll remember him, I think, for winning 14 French Open titles, to win the same Grand Slam at the same venue 14 times, rewrote the record books. We will remember the intensity with which he played his career, and we'll remember those early memories of him when he preferred the pirate pants and the sleeveless top, and he'd walk onto court wearing a bandana, and he was always a ball of energy as the coin toss was taking place. He was jumping up and down, and then he'd sprint to the back of the court in a zigzag formation to begin the warm-up, and he threw absolutely everything at his career. And that's what he said in the video he posted earlier today, that he leaves with the absolute peace of mind of a man who knows he's given his best, who's made an effort in every way possible.
Russell Fuller. Four decades on from her Ramsey Street teenage years.
Everybody needs. You're disturbing the whole street with a carry-on.
I don't hear anyone else complaining, you old bag.
Princess of Pop Kylie Minogue opens up to our correspondent.
What are people around the world doing to help tackle the climate emergency?
Climate shocks that we are experiencing.
Droughts, floods, decimated agriculture and so on.
The Climate Question from the BBC World Service looks for answers to those challenges posed by climate change.
How can we solve this?
It's all being discussed.
We only hear the bad stuff in the news, don't we? And there's loads of quiet progress.
Reasons to be hopeful.
Solutions exist. We just need to be able to implement them at scale.
The Climate Question. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
It's called the Living Planet Report. but dying planet might be a more apt description. The investigation by the Worldwide Fund for Nature has found a catastrophic loss of wildlife, with populations of amphibians, birds, fish, mammals and reptiles falling globally by 73% in 50 years. The head of WWF UK, Tanya Steele, says the destruction of habitats is pushing many species towards extinction.
We are exploiting our natural resources at an alarming rate, and we simply cannot afford to do it. The single greatest driver of wildlife loss is the loss of its wild places, and that's because we're converting them to grow food. Now, it's important that we do feed a growing population, but this is about how we steward and how we look after land for future generations.
We heard more about the loss of wildlife from our environment reporter, Helen Briggs.
This is a global average, but it basically means that if you go anywhere in the world, then you would expect to find only about a quarter of the population size that was there 50 years ago. It depends exactly where you are. Some parts of the world are more badly affected than others, but it is what's being described as an alarming depletion in wildlife. And then it points to generally this backdrop of the loss of nature. So it's habitat loss that is driving a lot of this decline. And that obviously has huge implications for the planet.
And presumably humans are at least partly to blame for this.
Yeah, the authors of the report very much point the finger at humans growing food, all sorts of things which are reducing habitat, squeezing out wild animals. And they're warning that when you combine it with climate change, you're pushing the world closer to dangerous tipping points. The loss of coral reefs, tipping the Amazon towards dangerous collapse. And this all comes in the run-up to a big biodiversity conference in Colombia and Cali, where countries get together to try and address biodiversity loss on a global scale.
Now, you say it's an average. Presumably, that means some species are doing worse than others. Why don't you pick out a few for us?
Yes, so we're only looking at vertebrates here, so mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, etc. We're not looking at insects in this. So some species are in very dramatic decline. River dolphins, for example, forest elephants, they're doing really badly. But the report does highlight some hope here. With intensive conservation, you can start to turn around declines. They point to things like a small increase in mountain gorillas following decades of conservation work. European bison have been reintroduced to 10 countries, so they're starting to increase in number as well. But really, the overall picture is one of stark decline, which is being highlighted in the run-up to the UN biodiversity meeting in Colombia.
Yeah, and what are the chances of that being able to do anything about this?
Well, 2 years ago, countries did sign a deal to save nature. So they promised by 2030 to halt the loss of biodiversity. And there's a huge number of promises there. So the world will be looking to Colombia to see whether that momentum of 2 years ago, countries are coming back and they have to produce their national plans in terms of how they're actually going to achieve this. And of course, then there's the question of actually how you get money flowing to countries in the global south who still have a richness of biodiversity that's been lost in many other countries around the world.
Helen Briggs speaking to Oliver Conway. Officials in Ukraine say 8 people have been killed after Russian missiles hit a container ship at a port in the Odessa region overnight. It's the 3rd attack on a civilian vessel this week. The strikes come as President Zelensky is on a European tour, visiting leaders in London, Paris and Rome on Thursday, as well as meeting the new Secretary General of NATO, Mark Rutte. Overnight, Ukraine's intelligence services say they carried out a successful drone strike on an ammunition depot in southern Russia. From Kyiv, our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, reports.
This is the 3rd Russian strike on a civilian cargo ship in Odessa in under a week, and it is the deadliest. 6 crew members were killed on board, and 2 men have since died in hospital. Residents of Odessa have described hearing the booms and feeling the shockwaves, and Ukrainian officials have condemned the latest attack as another Russian crime, meant to disrupt grain exports and harm the economy. The missile attacks, and there were more overnight across the country, came as President Zelensky toured Europe looking for support for his victory plan. That's his vision on how to end Russia's full-scale aggression. Mr. Zelensky says it's about creating the right conditions for a just end to this war. But he still has no approval from Western allies to use their long-range missiles against Russia. And here in Ukraine, people don't know how Mr. Zelensky's vision of victory actually looks. He had planned to discuss that again with the US president in Germany, but Joe Biden has stayed home to oversee the response to Hurricane Milton.
Sarah Rainsford. After 3 days of prizes honouring work in the sciences, the Nobel Prize for Literature has just been announced by the Swedish Academy. The South Korean writer Han Kang is this year's winner. Her best-known work is The Vegetarian, a novel about a woman's descent into mental illness. The arts journalist Vincent Dowd told me her win had been quite unexpected.
The bookies Ladbrokes, for instance, in the UK, OK, that's only one bookies, but even so, had her down as a 33-1 shot, massively behind frontrunners such as Gerald Munan and San Shue. However, I have to say, this is what tends to happen each year with this prize, that the people who seem to be frontrunners aren't. At 53, Han Kang is a relatively young winner. She started by publishing poetry in 1993, but she's now known much more as a novelist. The Nobel Prize Committee today spoke of her, and I quote, intense poetic prose that confronts historical traumas and exposes the fragility of human life. Without doubt, her best-known novel, I think, is The Vegetarian. Came out in three parts, starting in, I think, 2007. First of her books to be translated into English about 8 years later, and that started to build an international reputation for her. Indeed, that novel took the Man Booker International Prize in its translated form, and her next work, The White Book, was shortlisted for the same award. Very briefly, The Vegetarian is characteristic of her work, and following the big award today, I suspect many people will be reading it for the first time, or indeed rereading it. In the book, Yong-hee gives up meat eating, which radically changes her personality. She descends into, shall we say, a form of madness and believes she's turning into a tree. It's a fairly short book, which many critics adored, although, maybe because it's disturbing to read, the judges at the time of the Man Booker said it will linger long in the minds, maybe in the dreams of its readers. Other books include Greek Lessons and Human Acts. Not everything has been translated into English, but of course the Nobel isn't given for a single novel or a single set of poetry. It's given for a whole span of work. That's why I say to win at 53 is actually doing very well.
Vincent Dowd. The BBC weather app, trusted by millions here in Britain and around the world, has got it wrong. Very wrong. Forecasts today have been wildly inaccurate, and the organisation has apologised and is seeking to fix the issue. David Lewis is following the story.
People in the UK have an obsession with the weather. Four seasons in one day sometimes, and be safe to pack your umbrella and sunglasses for trips into town. But checking the weather app on the BBC this morning may have had some British people spluttering up their morning tea. Graphics online forecast wind speeds here in London in excess of 21,000 kilometres an hour. That's apocalyptic. For comparison, that would be 10 times speedier than gusts on the planet Neptune, the fastest recorded winds in the solar system. Not content with predicting Armageddon for the British capital, the app anticipated the heat in New York to be a scorching 384 degrees Celsius, vastly hotter than any recorded temperature on Earth. The good news, I suppose, was that the UV level was medium. Elsewhere around the globe, wind speeds in Rome were envisioned in the thousands of kilometres an hour. Speaking on air earlier today, BBC weather presenter Carol Kirkwood acknowledged the errors.
We're having a technical glitch at the moment. It's showing wind speeds far too fast, in fact, hurricane strength. And of course, that is not the case at all. So please do not be alarmed by that. We are on it. We're trying to fix it right now. So hopefully that will sort itself.
In a statement, BBC Weather apologised for the issues and said they were working very hard to fix the problem. So despite heat of more than 400 degrees forecast where I am today, in reality, outside New Broadcasting House here in central London, it's grey, overcast and drizzly. In other words, a depressingly familiar October day.
David Lewis. She began her acting days as Charlene in the Australian TV soap opera Neighbours before she achieved pop stardom. It was a music career many thought wouldn't last. But Kylie Minogue has defied all the critics. 38 years on, Kylie has clocked up 83 singles and is about to embark on her 15th world tour next year. The BBC's music correspondent Mark Savage has been to meet the Princess of Pop.
Last year, the viral smash Padam Padam put Kylie Minogue back at the top of the charts. It's the latest chapter in a career that's been full of ups and downs. But the star says she never takes success for granted.
It's so weird because I never stop working, but then there's these peaks. And I really look at it like, not that I'm a surfer, but I have caught a wave once in my life. So I understand the principle. A lot of paddling. We're paddling, paddling, paddling.
Everybody needs
you're disturbing the whole street with a carry-on.
I don't hear anyone else complaining, you old bag.
The world might have discovered Kylie through the Australian soap opera Neighbours, but her musical ambitions predated her acting career.
You and your brother and sister used to perform Grease Lightning in the front room.
We would do that. Grease Lightning, girl, Grease Lightning. The same front room where the record player was, and I would play the Beatles, the Stones, and then, yeah, I made a demo cassette when I was 17 with three songs on it. I did cry in the studio because I was kind of overwhelmed and nervous.
Her first hit single in the UK was I Should Be So Lucky. It was written in just 40 minutes, and many people predicted her singing career would last just as long.
Do you see yourself as a singer or an actress? What do you want to be?
Both.
You see, pop singing and being a hit maker, that can't last as long as being an actress.
No, true. I really don't know. I can only sort of think a week ahead.
People were pretty mean. What was the point where you felt, I'm actually confident in what I'm doing now?
I don't know what is in me that just made me keep going and work through that. You got to earn your stripes and that's cool. It wasn't cool people were as nasty as they were. And that's not some kind of invisible person behind a keyboard. These were grown adults who kind of should have known better.
4 decades and more than 80 hit singles later, Kylie has proved the critics wrong. Next year, she sets off on her 15th world tour.
Lights, camera, action, that's it.
But she says it's not all glitz and glamour.
The fast changes that you do on stage, because you have 7 or 8 outfits per show, and sometimes you're in and out of them in under a minute. How does that happen, practically?
I'm going to confess, a lot goes on in the quick change. I might swear a lot. It's frantic. It just takes one thing to go wrong and you're all freaking in the quick change. And I did pass by a wardrobe on a gig I did recently and I just said, I'm a despicable human being. I'm so sorry. And they're like, what happens in quick change stays in quick change.
What's your comfort clothes then when all of the stage costumes come off? Trackies, slippers?
Probably a really very worn pair of track pants and, you know, that one T-shirt. There's one that just, I don't know, it's in favour. That's the T-shirt for those 6 months. But yeah, comfort. I love it. When I go out, I wanna go out dancing. There's so much that's happened in my life that 8-year-old, 12-year-old, 15-year-old, 20-year-old me would have not been able to even compute. You're going to meet Prince one day. You're going to go to Paisley Park. He's going to write a song for you. You're going to sing on stage with Madonna. I mean,
I'm jealous.
I'm amazed. I'm like, is this even my life?
Kylie Minogue speaking to the BBC's music correspondent, Mark Savage. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was produced by Alice Adderley and was mixed by Joe McCartney. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.